Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we have now covered 22 amendments, now diving into the 23rd Amendment. And we've got Paul with us, which means that I'm at a position. Welcome back, Paul. We're now at a position where I can kind of talk about, you know, what's next, right? Because the light's at the end of the tunnel. Today's Thursday. Will we get done with, or will we finish? I'll get rid of the Constitution. Will we finish going through the Constitution today? And as I look at it, no, probably not. There's still a lot of things we're covering.
I don't think we'll finish today. You've got some unratified amendments here that'd be interesting to talk about.
Yes, right. The ERA and so forth. So what we have after this, folks, before we started the Constitution or reading the Constitution, we were covering the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. These were the mechanism, as we just spoke earlier this week, regarding the 49th Federalist Paper, that convention or that process, that meeting of the states where they basically follow a process of dealing with the breaches of the compact.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we clearly see what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison had done, as we talked about this, they didn't go out to try to create an Article 5 convention. They really wanted to coalesce the states into dealing with the breaches thereof. They didn't do that. And so as we're going through all of this, we're going to prove how they make their point that this is what has to happen. So when we're done with the Constitution, we're going to go back into those resolutions and get into the report.
Okay, so you're saying they didn't do that, not because they didn't try to do that. It just the states didn't join. They didn't.
Well, so
step up.
What Jefferson and Madison did was the appropriate thing. They actually went down the path of doing what was appropriate. The other states, because they were okay with the violations of the compact, they weren't willing to stand up.
And it's hard for me to believe they were okay with it. Were they just...
Were Federalists. They wanted to see they wanted to see government grow. And Jefferson and Madison banked on the people side, that the people didn't want a growing, you know, government consuming more and more power.
It is, Jerry, I need to add that it's so many things happened in the history that we've seen in going through the Constitution, the amendments, that's providential. It's providential that Jefferson and Madison had the opportunity to show us what it is we're supposed to do. Do you understand what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's these things happened, and they gave us, not only does the Constitution have what we need, but we have historical precedent for what we need to do. And that's why I'm really grateful for what the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. Uh-huh. They're golden.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So anyway, didn't mean to stray, but I thought that would be important to notice.
No, absolutely. It's important. And it's ultimately, once we do the resolutions, then we're going to go through. I will go through, because I've already promised to bring Angeline back to talk about the Republic Review. How it, when you look at what Jefferson and Madison were doing, it is precisely what they were talking about. They just didn't sit down and clarify the structure, the process, what has to happen, how it's going to happen. They just said, we need to get together. It's basically like politicians, you know, we're just going to get together and do what's obvious. nobody knows what that obvious is, especially today.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
Okay, so we're on 23, right?
That is correct.
All right, this is interesting. Section 1. The district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall appoint in such manner as the Congress may direct a number of electors of president and vice president equal to the whole number of senators and representatives in Congress, to which the district would be entitled if it were a state, but in no event more than the least populous state. They shall be in addition to those appointed by the states, but they shall be considered for the purposes of the election of president and vice president to be electors appointed by a state, and they shall meet in the district and perform such duties as provided by the 12th article of amendment. And of course, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Well, you've got this highlighted in the most serious condition.
Yeah, so actually, this really needs to be highlighted in a way how this actually violates the Constitution. This itself violates the Constitution. The District of Columbia is autonomous. It's not to have representation. It is the seat of government. It is where we send those who are going to govern us and govern us from there. Now, they have this responsibility to govern themselves. And so usually when you set up the kitchen, you know, you put all your food in one area and, you know, your all the things to making food are in that area. And so what do you find in the area of making food?
You find stove.
No.
You find something to cook with,
right? So over time, when you start cooking, you start finding rats and you start finding mice and you start finding a subculture of those feeding off of the making of the food.
Unless, of course, you're cleaning very diligently, right?
Yeah, so I'm sure that there's, you know, the General Accounting Office, there were things that were created that were necessary, but when it came to crumbs falling off the plate, it became pretty obvious that, hey, you know, there's a great opportunity to live in the District of Columbia. Now, it was clear in the Constitution, it's kind of like you've got an airport. Right? The military puts an airport out in the middle of nowhere. And so they have everybody in housing or on base that operate that airport. Now, corporations that are serving logistics and everything else, they, you know, set up shop outside that airport for distribution and so forth so that they can better serve the airport, this military airbase. And over time, you know, people start developing homes outside that military airport. And as homes and, you know, development continue and continue, and over time, you know, that whole area, let's just say that whole area was a bunch of agricultural fields. And, you know, orange fields, strawberry fields, asparagus fields, just a whole bunch of agricultural fields. And so in the middle of this huge, I mean, we're talking, you know, probably 50 miles of fields, you put this small military base there. Eventually, you know, the property around it, the value of it becomes greater and greater to convert that from growing food to serving the airport and the people of that facility. Eventually, you create a town. And sometimes those towns are named after the airport itself.
Correct.
And how long does it take from the point of the airport being created to where the, you know, a town is created as an offset? In other words, you know, now we have a town called, you know, that airport. And now we have this this shifting of wanting that airport there. In other words, all of a sudden people realize, well, you know, we live under this airport and it sure is noisy. And next thing you know, you have the people in the town that have, you know, created a life there that says, you know what, we need to shut down. You guys can't operate all the time anymore. You have to turn off your jets and your aircraft operations after a certain hour. And you can't operate until a certain hour in the day. So now all of a sudden the people of the town start saying, you know, these are the days we want you to operate. These are the times we want you to operate on those days. Eventually, the people, there's a movement to say, we need to shut this airport down. Imagine what just happened. You just created something that was necessary. And over time, through the natural cycle of the process, it ends up destroying itself.
That. I'm struggling with this because I've done military contracts at military airports. And these people that are depending on this for their livelihood, typically they want to see it grow.
Usually, so, yes, those people. But, you know, it's the hate to say it. In this particular case, the airport I just mentioned was El Toro.
Okay. Is that in, all right, I'm not familiar with it.
Yes, was this because in, it was.
One, where was this? Was this in California?
United States Marine Corps USMCAS El Toro. Yes, it was north of San Juan Capistrano, which was Nixon's, you know, fly-in airport. When he became president, they grew it to become this major airport.
Now, so it this actually happened.
Oh, absolutely, it happened. And there's a town called El Toro. And El Toro eventually, you know, the city council and everybody else, they, because they actually became progressive, they looked at the military as, you know, unnecessary. Let's kill this thing. We don't need it anymore. And so the entity that was created, the, you know, the spirit of that entity kills itself. And I don't think that was the outcome that they were seeking, but that's what ends up happening. And what does this have to do with DC? So DC was created to be autonomous. DC was created to be in the area where the federal government had no encumbrance.
Right.
And what came along with that was the inability to, you know, involve itself in those processes. In other words, you can't be a state.
Okay.
You know, you live there, that's tough. You can't be a state. You don't get to vote.
There,
you,
right.
You do not get an elector to vote. And
well, here's my... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, my next question was, if they don't get an elector to vote, then is it possible that people who live there shouldn't be taxed?
So they should...
No taxation without representation.
No. So... Do you have a government that you create in policing itself and so forth? And can you actually tax? Technically, who should pay for its own policing? The people, the 50 states, the people of the 50 states, or the creature itself? If the creature wants to have security and have its own police force to protect themselves. Now, see, here's the other thing. Where do most of the people live? Where do most of the people that are senators and so forth, where do they live? Do they live within the district or do they live within the states just outside of the district?
I think they live within the states just outside the district.
There you go. And so many of those, as Maryland became more and more progressive and had, you know, a really bad progressive income tax, many people that were affluent ended up fleeing Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Maryland, I mean, they are, and we're seeing Virginia going that way too. Anyway, the bottom line is the District of Columbia was created for autonomy. If you move there, these are the consequences for living there. Now, here's the benefits for living there. You get that close to where you have the security of, you know, a housing market that probably will never fluctuate.
Okay.
Because government will always have to exist, at least that government and so forth. I mean, so there's some benefits to living in the district. but sure. You can't have your bread and eat it too. You can't create a state out of the District of Columbia. You just can't. Mm-hmm. It was defined clearly to not allow that to happen. And so here's what they did, though. They actually amended the Constitution to give the people the ability to do this. And technically, this actually flies in the face of the definition. So, but bottom line, because it is a constitutional amendment, I hate to say it, but it mm-hmm. is a legitimate process.
Okay.
And so I just highlighted it because this actually defies the whole point in having the District of Columbia.
Okay.
And as far as I'm concerned, we've reached the point where the District of Columbia, you know, we should actually consider getting rid of it.
Really?
Yes. Yep.
And not having an independent seat of government?
Correct. Not having an independent. Well, why did we have to have a seat? Why did there have to be a seat?
Well, there had to be
a place for everybody to descend upon so that they could govern, so that they could do their job.
And it had to be independent from other states, you know?
Because they realized that this was a functioning government.
Okay.
Because they lived in a world that could not imagine virtuality.
Correct.
Clearly, when we look at, go back to Article 1, Section 8, and the very last part where it talks about needful buildings, right? So they need buildings? Yeah, they need buildings, for, you know, places for the GOA, places for the Pentagon, those types of things. But they don't need the seat of government anymore.
Wait a minute. So in other words, if they have needful buildings, then we can give the territory that was ceded to the federal government back to the states.
That is correct. Right? That is correct.
You could make Washington, D.C. a monument, you know, a historical.
Uh-huh.
Historical monument.
Well, that's, we could, or we could just actually let the free market. But here's, so this is where we really need to, you know, look at what would be best. Do we really need to have, and so it's already proven to become a strategic weak point of having all your eggs in one basket.
Yes.
So to me, I think that the House of Representatives, if they're going to have a meeting place, it should be somewhere else. It should be in a needful building somewhere else. And, you know, just take a dart, stand back 20 feet and just throw the dart at a picture of the United States. And on that picture, make sure you put Hawaii and Alaska because they could be points. You know, and good luck hitting Hawaii, by the way.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like hitting the bullseye. You better be good. But my point is that, you know, wherever that dart lands, it could, you know, leave it to chance, but wherever that dart hits, okay, that's where you're going to put the seat of the House of Representatives. And nobody's going to like it, especially those people that might be the House of Representatives, but technically that's not where they're going to be working. The only reason that they would need to come together is for security purposes, and that can act. We can mitigate the physical requirement of our representatives ever coming together again. We can mitigate all of that.
Sure.
And so, well, why don't we? You know, look at how much money gets poured into the district for the function of it being a district.
Why don't we? I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Not only would it no longer be necessary, but you disperse. You know, what happens is when you have, what has been happening is you've had this concentrated power attract, and I'm going to say bottom feeders, maybe not bottom feeders, but it attracts.
No, it does. Elements. It does. Absolutely. You're right.
Yeah, right. You know, it attracts, for lack of a better term, blood-sucking parasites. okay, who really are looking for to feed at the public trough at the expense of the people.
So we've talked about the judiciary, because what about the judiciary? What about the president? You know what? Okay. I'm okay. I am absolutely okay if every state in the union basically prepared themselves a house for the president, so that, you know, every term the president will stay somewhere else.
Okay.
Or the president can choose where he's going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what they've done, I mean, it's a marvel of the way they've secured and protected themselves, because they have all these tunnels and all sorts of artifacts. So you go, oh my gosh, wow. That, you know, they spared themselves no expense in protecting themselves from us.
Right.
But they've lost sight of the fact that we, the people, are the government.
Right.
Okay. So I'm just laying it out there that this right here, this amendment, even though it legitimized what they did, it literally violated the spirit of the District of Columbia being autonomous. Mm-hmm. You know, eventually, can they amend the Constitution to give themselves, you know, benefits, or, you know, absolutely. And the states are fools to allow these things to have been ratified. But if you look at the date, this is when democracy was alive and well in America. And sure, these people deserved their part in democracy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of really living the spirit of individual sovereignty and individual liberty and having autonomy for the federal government, they said, no, we have to have our own elector as well. Or electors, I should say. So anyway, we can move on to the 24th.
So I'm looking at the 24th, and before I even get to the end of the sentence, I see alarm bells going off. But let me read it. The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other elections for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax. This was proposed in 62. The problem I have with this is the term primary.
Yep.
It stands out like a sore thumb to me, because they're injecting something now into this that has become a tradition. That, and I don't know the ratification debates on this, but it's become a tradition that I would say is injected into the Constitution, but it's not with the spirit of the Constitution. It's injecting the term primaries when primaries aren't part of the electoral process, at least not for president.
That is correct.
Okay. And that's what it's referring to, president or vice president.
Yeah, so by this point in time, the states were actually having primaries, violating the Constitution. This doesn't authorize the states to have primaries. It basically says, if you're going to have any form of an election regarding a federal election, any form, that the right of the person to vote shall not be denied or abridged because of their inability to pay a tax or a poll tax. And so they have the right to vote. Now, we'll talk about this when we come back from the break regarding, you know, where there's a problem with this and how we really need to break this out, because we have what we use in our elections is not just elections of representation. We'll be right back after this promo.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we have, and I believe that every person should have a right to vote for who represents them. That should not be denied. I'm okay with that concept, but I'm not okay with the concept that that person that has that right for voting for representation can be involved in elections. They have no dog in that fight, or they have no reason to be able to vote. And I'll give you a good example is property tax. If you don't own property, you should not be able to vote for property tax. And so there's lots of people out there, Paul, that, you know, are, I'll say, they're talking about how immoral property taxes and so forth. I honestly believe that it has become immoral the way they've used property tax and taking away property and so forth because of those who have been voting for property tax that have no, they have no property. They should not be voting. Have you ever seen a corporation actually destroy itself by giving and, you know, taking from those in the corporation and giving to those outside the corporation?
I think that's happening now.
Well, no. So look at the four, when I say legitimate within the corporation governance, I'm saying the Ford governing body. The voting for that and their bylaws and how they function and how they govern themselves, the people that have any say in voting are those people who are there to protect the Ford Motor Company.
They're the stockholders.
The stockholders, absolutely.
Right?
Sure. Right. So in other words, they have stake in Ford.
Sure.
Those people who have stake in Missouri have property.
Mm-hmm.
Those people who have, because that's the whole point of stake. If you look up stakeholder, that's the person who owns. That's the person who's holding. And so, you know, the person who has stake, if, you know, if they're basically, what do they call that? Underwriting. A stakeholder underwrites those, you know, give me some money and I'll go gamble or what have you. You have to have stake in the game.
Right.
And I know there's a lot of people, that's a buzzword, you know, that's not a good term. Actually, in context to this, it is. Because a person that doesn't have stake in the game, if you don't have property, mm-hmm. why is it that you can vote on a property tax? And sure. As a matter of fact, if you have multiple properties, let's say you have a thriving business where you have three stores or three restaurants throughout your state.
Mm-hmm.
And in every county where your business exists, they want to raise taxes on your business. You have stake in that county regarding that tax. You should be able to vote in that county to say no or sure. yes. And so the point is that, you know, we have this underlying, you know, freedom or this right to vote. But why is it that we have a right to vote for everything?
So what I hear you saying here is, and I think a lot of people don't understand this, the origin of the poll tax.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But I think the viewpoint of when this happened, like was in the 60s, what, right?
Yep.
Early 60s?
Uh-huh.
Was that people who look like me were being denied the right to vote, and let's suppose that they did own property. Okay, well, in the case of the president, that might be something different. But certainly makes sense that stakeholders should be the people who vote in something that affects them. And I think that the timing of this had to do with what was happening to black people, particularly in the South, and which, you know, GR, they had to, there's a YouTube video called No Guns for Negroes. And it actually documents how black people had to show up armed at the polls to protect their voters. And by the way, it worked in the South. So I think, you know, you have the one side in which, yes, obviously, if you have a stake in the game, you should be able to vote. And if you don't, you shouldn't. But we had the pendulum which swung hard the other way, in which people were being denied the right to vote because of the color of their skin. And I think the timing of this probably is why it was, you know, why that came out. See, how long did it take to do that? It was 2 years to ratify. You think?
So, right. And this all was a part of, or all in play with the Equal Rights Amendment, right? And so...
The Equal Rights Amendment or the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, I'm sorry. Equal Rights Amendment is the ERA. I misspoke.
Right.
It's the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, okay.
That's what I meant. Because the Civil Rights Act actually came on the heels of, I believe, of this. But I absolutely understand that people were being basically banned or kept, or their right to vote was being abridged because of tax.
Right.
I'm okay with people having the right to vote for their representation. Mm-hmm. That should be protected. But you should not have it on your ballot. We have the technology and the ability to say you have no right to vote in this measure, this initiative, this legislation that there is for taxing property, mm-hmm. or for taxing hotels, or you have to be a hotel owner to basically say we want to impose a hotel tax.
That would be interesting.
There right? you go. Because, see, what ends up happening is because that is Tytler's cycle of democracy. Alexander Tytler, when he created the cycle of democracy, he proved that over time, when people realized that they could be fed, you know, through their election system by putting taxes on everything and everybody, that's mm-hmm. how they destroy you.
Right.
And so you can't necessarily tax the hotel companies, but what you can do is you can create an environment that makes it hard for hotel companies to thrive. Bottom line, that hotel started in that locale, in that vicinity, based upon some symbiosis, some mutually benefiting situation that benefited the people via employment. Mm-hmm. And the hotel via, you know, income, getting people sure. to stay there when they came to town. And sure. so when things become lopsided, when, you know, all of a sudden people want to just make more and make more and make more, or make something more out
or
of
take
it.
Take more and take more. And take
that's
more, right.
Take. You're right. Absolutely. That's the whole point. And I think poll taxes or this whole carte blanche, you can't have a poll tax, I think is inappropriate. I think it should be that voting for representation, your representative cannot be denied or disparaged or abridged via a tax in any form. Mm. But all other things can. There can be some form or requirement, and it only makes sense that you have to be a stakeholder. You have to be in that process, because this is how we take away the predatory taxation that the progressives have on corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, the next one, which is the 25th, okay, this was proposed in 65 and ratified in 67.
Boy, the 60s were busy for amendments, weren't
amendments,
they?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go. 25th Amendment. In case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president.
Makes Section sense, two. Right? That makes sense,
yeah,
okay.
Course. It makes sense. In fact, I think that was understood, but okay. Section 2, whenever there is a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take office upon confirmation by majority vote of both houses of Congress. Section 3, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the vice president as acting president.
Now, there's a lot of people that thought that these next couple would be playing a factor with Biden. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 4. Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or such other body as Congress may by law provide.
Okay, hold on here now. What do they mean by "and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may"? So, in other words, Congress can provide by law other body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Principal
right.
officers of another body. So, let's dissect that right there.
Okay.
Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers, so in other words, let's say the president had some real loyalists and the vice president, like Pence, wanted to go rogue. Well, he knew he couldn't get the executives to act, or I should say, the executive secretaries of the departments to, you know, go against Trump. So he would have needed Congress to identify another body by law that would empower the vice president to remove a sitting president.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what they're saying here. But bottom line, the reality is that this amendment actually empowers the vice president and the executive secretaries of the different departments to actually, all they need is a majority of these secretaries to stand up and say, this person is no longer fit. Keep going.
Right. Okay. Let's see.
And then they transmit to the president pro tem. Keep going.
Right. So when the president transmits to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, this is his written declaration. We read that one.
Uh-huh.
Right?
No,
okay.
Whenever
the vice president, huh? Did I not read that?
We ended up with, in section four, ended on Congress may provide by law, and then I stopped you. So
Okay. May by law provide. Transmit to the, whenever the vice president and majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting president.
There you go. Okay. So, in other words, that sets it all up that the vice president could actually commit almost like a coup in removing the president.
Sure.
Okay. And it continues, the next part.
Yeah. Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive department or of such other body as Congress may by law provide transmit within 4 days to the President pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Thereupon, Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours for that purpose, if not in session. If the Congress, hang on a minute, not in session, if the Congress within 21 days after receipt of letter of the latter written declaration, or if Congress is not in session within 21 days after Congress is required to assemble, determines by two-thirds of vote of both houses that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President shall continue to discharge the same as acting President. Otherwise, the President shall resume the powers and duties of his office.
So, in other words, Congress really needs to be on board with a shenanigan, right? Because mm-hmm. it clearly has Congress as the keeper of the balancing of the scale.
Correct. Well, you've got the representatives of the states and the people. So those representatives, ideally, are involved.
Right. So if you have a really corrupt Congress and you have a corrupt vice president like we did with Pence, then they could have actually gotten away with, because all Congress needed to do was define who that other body would have been instead of the executive secretaries.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. You know, Congress could decide to do that at any time, actually. Right?
Well, it still has to come from it's initiated by the vice president.
Let me see what it says. It says whenever I want to see.
Whenever the vice president and majority of the principal officers, or by a body that Congress provides.
Or of such other body as Congress may provide. That's an or there.
Right. So, right? But it still has to include the vice president. And then that has to be a transmission from the vice president and this body or bodies transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. So, in other words, it still requires the vice president to, you know, initiate the process.
Okay.
So now the next one, which is the 25th, is that right?
No, the 26th.
26th. I'm sorry, that was the 25th.
Yeah.
Okay, so proposed in 71, ratified in 71. Boom, boom.
That was fast also.
Yep.
The right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age. I remember this one because the year I turned 18 was the year I was allowed to vote. Okay. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So that right there was the coming of age of the progressive era.
Okay.
Because when we look at the stage of life where somebody really understands what's going on, at age 1 through 12, 14, you know, that person really doesn't know what's going on, and they put in place all faith in somebody that's more competent than them. 9 times out of 10, because of our society and the bedrock of the family, that's the parents. Now, mm-hmm. we've perverted that to where the teachers have become, because I believe the teachers, with their treats and with the way they do the rewarding and the manipulation, have, you know, quickly become the trusted body because of the way they teach today. The teachers in our education system have basically supplanted themselves as that trusted body, right? And so, you know, bottom line is that the children are not competent to think for themselves. In other words, they don't have the mental faculties, the cognizance, and the cognitive power to understand the ramifications of what they're doing, and they surrender to that greater authority. Now, we all understand that right after that is the teenage years, the years of rebellion and shifting from being subjugated or being controlled by a competent authority and fighting for one's independence. When does that end, and when does that actually go into a point of, I'll just say, I guess the best word, because I'm looking for the best word for this, I would probably say where they have a level of wisdom or providence. Because you actually see through the mental development of a human that at age 18, do you believe that a human is mentally developed enough to really understand the ramifications of what they're doing in politics and government?
No, I would have to say that it is probably dependent on the culture and the times.
I would have to say that based on our education system, with the way children are programmed, this is the epitome of weaponizing children by giving them the power to vote.
Okay. Well, I would, considering the circumstances today, I would agree with you. But I think that it is a sliding scale based on the society and the norms. Okay, in Jefferson's and Madison's day, the age was determined by states. Okay, but I think Jefferson had, I'll have to look it up. I think he graduated from college by the time he was 16. They were much more mature and well-read, and it would have been a different thing in their day and time. But today,
not really, because even Thomas Jefferson looked at, so a little tidbit. John Adams was absolutely embarrassed that his grandson was kicked out of Harvard for being drunk and disorderly.
Okay.
And Thomas Jefferson said, hey, who of us doesn't have the indiscretion of youth? I mean, we were that way.
Okay.
Thomas Jefferson, I think it was in his 17th year, or when he was, in his moving into his first year in college, where this is when he basically galvanized his position on Christianity and felt that you'll find this in Dumas Malone, I believe, his six-book biography, where Thomas Jefferson felt that he couldn't subscribe to any of the Christian churches of the time because one of his heroes, Sir Isaac Newton, basically felt that the true church that Christ created didn't exist on the earth at that point in time.
Okay. And I wouldn't think that was a bad thing.
The way the society looked at him, that was very rebellious, and he was actually asked, it was a cast out because he became an ideologue. These are the years of stupid ideologueness. In other words, you just buy into something because it seemed like a really good thing. It took time for Jefferson to, come to his own regarding Christianity.
Interestingly, I don't know if you have it. I've got a copy of something called Jefferson's Bible. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Jefferson was, people call Jefferson a deist because if anyone calls Jefferson a deist, they didn't read his writing.
Right.
Okay. They completely misunderstood him. All right. I just think he was, I would almost say, wisely and thoughtfully considering, what was going on at the time. And that's probably a discussion we could have far more at some time in the future.
Uh-huh.
Looking at today, looking at how schools have such an influence over youth and children, and parents' influence is being lost.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't. I, you know, I don't know if 30 wouldn't be the right age. Okay,
but I'm just saying, 18.
You've got
18. These kids are not ready to actually deal with the consequences of their stupidity.
Yeah, I don't think that's universal, but it's large. Okay, I just think it's.
Greatly
damaged.
But I believe that this amendment has set us up, because I have seen, we saw it in Washington State, where they use kids. Literally, it was the younger vote that got out, and it was during an off election year where they had homosexual marriage on the ballot, like with your teachers and all of that, and the kids turned out the vote. And they legalized homosexual marriage in Washington State. And I believe they did the same thing with abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can actually weaponize the kids, because I believe it was 1972 where Washington State legalized abortion.
Well, then that would have been the year that that 18-year-olds were able to vote.
Yeah. Yes, it would have been. And it was. And go look, folks, tell me if I'm wrong, that Washington State did not legalize abortion for the state of Washington in 1972.
Sure.
Okay, so the next one is inoperative because it expired in 1982.
Okay. This is the equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The Congress shall have power to enforce this by appropriate legislation. Provisions of this article, this amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Now, I've got a comment on this, and it's really quick.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You know, in the Declaration of Independence, we're told that we have the right to, life, liberty, and God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So what are these extra rights that are being asked for? You know what I mean? What is
so the?
You know what is meant by the equality of rights?
So equality of rights makes sure that if there's any perceived advantage one way or the other, it has to be equally done. In other words, in that point in time in the 70s, there was these opportunities that women had protections. And there were men that, didn't have protections, but in some ways men had. So there, both sides had their kind of protections. And in business or what have you, men probably had more protections. And in homes, women had more protections. In other words, if you really look at what was going to happen, this basically said everything has to be equal. In your divorce, everything has to be equal. Well, back in those days, the women had advantages in the divorce. They got the kids. They got the house. They got everything in most cases. As things started shifting away from protecting women and or protecting men and those roles and the important things that they were doing, whether that be the father, the patriarch, the matriarch or the mother, and those things. This opened the door for the federal government to actually start regulating and making sure that, they could even out the scale one way or the other. It was a failed amendment, and it never passed. We'll cover this when we come back. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.